Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got to know.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Coming up on the show today, coverage of our weekend in Las Vegas at Caesars Palace at the NBC National Heads Up Poker Championship. In fact, we've got interviews that we recorded there. A great one coming up this hour. Two great ones, in fact. Phil Galfond and Joe Hashem together. We interviewed them just moments before they went head-to-head in the NBC Heads Up. And you'll also hear from Vanessa Selbst, one of the other players in the field of 64, who will talk a little bit about that controversial hand on last weekend's high-stakes poker where she got it all in for a couple of $100,000 against a millionaire amateur and lost it all. She'll explain why she did that in the interview we're going to play for you today. Hello, I am Paul Harrah's back in St. Louis at the featured table at Harrah's St. Louis in the poker room where the Bad Beat jackpot is up to $168,000 and we've got tournament games and cash games going on as well. Meanwhile, my partner Dennis Phillips is not in St. Louis and is not in Las Vegas. He's at a ball game in Arizona. Hi, Dennis, how are you?
How you doing, Paul? And I have to tell everybody that so far Paul has cost me one souvenir ball.
Explain why.
I was walking up here to make this call. Todd Helton was at the plate. He fouled one off into the right field just out of bounds, and it landed about 10 feet from me. And I'm sitting there talking to Paul and turning around, and I'm the closest person to him for about about a split second. Then, of course, about 10 people fall on the ball, and it's gone, but, you know. It's fabulous weather. I'm out at a place called the Salt River Fields. It's in Scottsdale. It's the brand-new setup for the Arizona and for Colorado for their spring training. It's a fabulous place. There's about a dozen practice fields around here. There's a batting cage that runs as long as you can possibly see here. There's pitcher's mounds, but it looks like about a dozen of them in a row right here that people can do. And the stadium itself is just gorgeous, state-of-the-art, totally set up, fan favorite because it's lots of elbow room in that. It's a gorgeous day to watch a spring training game, too. Cubs and the Rockies is what I'm watching.
And give us an update, you know, before we go to our KFNS scoreboard later on. Give us the score.
Well, so far it's a fairly close game. It's been a pitcher's duel a little bit. Sembrano is pitching. Unfortunately, he's given up a couple of runs. Cubs are still blanked out. But, you know, we'll see what happens. It's early. They're only in inning four right now.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about our weekend in Vegas. You played in the NBC Heads Up. Last year, you came in third. This year, you started out against Eric Lindgren and got past him. And then in the second round, you had a rematch against the godfather of poker, Doyle Brunson.
Yep, it was, and it was exactly that, a rematch. Doyle's a great guy. We sat down and talked. He just recently got out of the hospital. He had a growth removed from his arm, and it was kind of interesting. He said it was the same hospital he went into in 1962 to have another growth removed, and the doctor pulled up his old records and sat there and was totally flabbergasted. 48 years ago, they gave him 6 months to live. I think he survived.
Yeah.
And he's in great shape and great health, and he says they cut out a little piece of me, but all it did was make him a couple of pounds lighter. Everything else is going good.
I think that may be the second time in his life that he has beaten cancer.
It might well be. Might well be. But he looked healthy. He was a little weak and that, and hadn't played a whole lot of poker. But the competitive spirit came out, shall we say.
Yeah.
I got him down 3-1. In chips. At one time, in fact, I even had him 4-1 in chips. Had him below 20,000. We started with 50K. Blinds in this thing go up every 15 minutes, so it's an extremely aggressive one. Doyle did what Doyle does very well, did exactly what he should do, and started getting very, very aggressive and started shoving. He shoved on me four different times, and I folded all four of them. The fifth time he shoved, I looked down at an ace-3 of diamonds. best hand I'd had so far against it. At that time, he'd built it up to about 26,000. I had about 74,000. And I went into the tank for a couple of minutes, kept looking at him, kept looking at the hands, the rest of it. I decided the worst-case scenario I was here was that he had an ace rag. And if he had, like, ace-5, he had a little bit of a favor. He's a small edge. But other than that, I just couldn't lay it down, and I called. He yep. looked at me, his shoulder dropped a little bit, and he said, nice call. And I went, great, I got him killed. And he turned over a queen jack of spades. He wasn't that. I did have him about a 55-45 advantage, but it wasn't a major one. And Jack comes out there. It came king-king jack, I believe, on the flop, and blank-blank. So I doubled him up. All of a sudden, he has about 55 to my 45. A few hands later, I'm down to about 40,000. I look at pocket sevens. He puts a small raise in. I re-raise, and he shoved. At this stage, I've got almost better than a quarter of my chips in. Lines are at 15-3, 3,000. They're about to go to 4,000, 2,000. I went ahead and called, and it was a classic race. What happens many, many times in these heads up when you have two pros playing against each other, it goes up to the blind levels, and you get into a race, and you've got to win the race. Well, his ace, queen of spades, outlasted my two sevens, and I was out of the tournament.
Yeah, he hit a queen on the flop. I want to go back to the hand where you called with ace-3 after he had shoved, and you said, you know, you thought maybe he might have ace rag or something like that, in which case he was a little bit of a favorite. Some of our listeners might think, well, no, you would have to catch a 3 in order to beat him there. But the fact is, if you both have an ace and you both have a low enough kicker, there are going to be many, many situations there where you're going to get 4 overcards to whatever his kicker is, a 4, a 5, or a 6, and you're going to end up chopping the pot. So you're not really as much of a dog as people might have thought you would be in that situation, right?
Oh, not even close. Yeah, it's almost almost even. If you look at it, if he has ace-5, unless you have a deuce 4 come on during those 5 cards, you're going to end up chopping it, or one of them win. I mean, that's just about all there is to it.
Yep.
So, if he had ace-5, ace-6, something like that, the odds are we're going to chop it, you know, and if one of us gets lucky enough to catch the 3 or the 6, then well, so be it.
On that hand, I was watching. I was just maybe about 10 or 15 feet away from you because it's not a large set there, and I'll explain a little bit about the setup there in just a moment here. But on that hand, Doyle was facing us in the audience on your side, and it just didn't seem like he was 100% confident. Now, of course, this is one of the greatest poker players of all time, a guy who has given up more tells and reverse tells than you and I will ever even think of. But at that point...
No.
At that point, from where I was sitting, I said to myself, he doesn't have a monster. He might have a good hand, but he doesn't have a monster. Did you see the same thing and say the same thing to yourself?
Well, that was just it. This was no instant call or anything like that. I take my time. Doyle, you don't want to give chips. I didn't want to double him up. I had a big advantage. I wanted to look down at, you know, pocket jacks where it's a no-brainer and you just throw the chips in there. But, of course, the A3 after he shoved is like, ugh. You know, do I or don't I? But, yeah, my read on it was definitely different than it had been in previous hands. He showed me pocket kings earlier in one of those 4 shoves. You know, he had another ace. He showed me the ace. I don't know what was the ace of clubs. I don't know what he had with it. He, you know, definitely was giving off a different vibe, I guess is the easiest way to do it,
yep,
with that hand than he had on the others. And, again, people got to realize, if you don't play heads up, you've got to realize this, you're going to get your chips in when you're uncomfortable. You're going to put more at risk than you would like to in a normal ring game or something. But that's the nature of the beast.
Right.
You've got to do it, and you can't be scared. 15-minute rounds, and they skip rounds. It went from 12-6 to 1-2. You know, there was no 8-16 or anything like that on it.
Right.
And I went from 24-12 to 3-15, and it was going to go to 4-2 on the next one. I mean, it just is aggressive. You've got to get your chips in there.
Yeah, by the time you get to the third or fourth level, a pair of sevens is a monster hand at that point, and so that's what you got it in with, and unfortunately you got knocked out in the second round. Let's offer big congratulations to, well, I'm almost sick of saying it this year, because we're congratulating Eric Seidel, who is having... one of the greatest first quarters of a year I've ever heard of. His winnings exceed $4.3 million just since January 1st.
Yeah, and I agree with you totally, but I don't want to slight Chris Moneymaker. That's the deepest Chris has ever run into this event.
Yep.
I believe now with the main event that he had in the Bahamas in January and this one are the second and the third biggest caches he's ever had.
Yep. You're right.
So he's doing very well.
Chris was the runner-up here. Eric Seidel beat him, and Eric won $750K, which now means that he is number one on the all-time earnings list. Congratulations to him for that. But Chris Moneymaker, who did come in 11th in the PCA main event in January and took down $130K there, outlasted John Reisner and Jungle Man Cates and Doyle and David Oppenheim and Jonathan Duhamel, and won $300,000 and was playing some of the best poker I've ever seen Chris play.
Yeah, I don't know what has changed. I mean, I've had some talks with him. We discussed poker a little bit, but my hat's off to him. It's definitely working. He's a guy now that nobody wants to face, heads up or in a ring game or whatever. His game has definitely sharpened up.
Yep.
And that just goes to prove this guy in 03 won the main event. He's now had 8 years of working on this, and now his game is improving again. You always got to work on it. It wouldn't surprise me what Doyle said. His game has improved in some aspects. This game, it'll kill you if you just set. You've got to keep working on it.
Absolutely. And by the way, there were some young guns in there. You know, I mentioned Andrew Robel, Daniel Jungleman Cates, Jonathan Duhamel was in there, a bunch of these young guys. But it was interesting to see you and Doyle as the two oldest guys in there. who wins it? Eric Seidel. You know, a guy who was from the beginning of this poker boom, Chris Moneymaker, all having incredible runs here and taking the whole thing down. A couple of quick little stories I got to tell you about this. One was on Thursday night, we went to the draw party at Pure, the nightclub at Caesar's Palace, where they chose which of the 64 were going to play against each other. That's where they all got paired up. And when Gavin Smith's ping pong ball was pulled out of the hopper, they brought Gus Hansen up as his opponent, and Gavin immediately offered up a prop bet. As you know, if you listen to this show, Gavin, known for making wacky prop bets, as soon as Gus got up there, Gavin said, "Gus, I'll have a prop bet with you. If you win, I will shave my head. If I win, you have to grow your hair for 2 years without cutting it at all." And Gus immediately said, "No bet."
Yeah, that was hilarious. Gavin is always good. He's always entertaining. He's always lightens the mood in that. And by the way, you need to let everybody realize that we now have the Gus Hansen interview on our podcast, in which I was amazed and shocked and loved the interview with him.
Yep.
When she talked about his philosophy and how he has changed it and how his game has improved so much, he's picked up several million dollars in the last 6-8 months now, both in tournaments and online.
Yep, you're absolutely right. You talk about how you need to keep improving your game. That's what Gus talked about. Now, this is a podcast-only show. It will not be broadcast on KFNS. We put it out on Saturday. We did so many interviews, and some of them were timely to the NBC Heads Up Poker Championship, that we wanted to get it out right away. So on Saturday, we put out a podcast that has Gus Hansen talking about changing his strategy and making millions because of it in the last year. A hot young player named Faraz Jaka, who explains why he was nicknamed The Toilet, and one of the great poker veterans of all time, Barry Greenstein, rejoined us and talked about all things poker, all things Bobby's Room, the new Bobby's Room over at Aria, named after Bobby Bland, and also about some poker legislation and things. If you want to listen to that show, you'll have to go to Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, and it is posted right now as a podcast, or for those of you who subscribe via iTunes, you will have already gotten that downloaded, or next time you refresh your podcast list, it will be in there in addition to today's show. So that was show number 109, and this is show number 110 today. And as I mentioned, we do have the segments coming up with Phil Galfond and Joe Hashem and Vanessa Selbst. Dennis, do you mind if I tell the story of my wild poker night after you went to bed on Friday night?
Folks, you got to hear this from Paul, but by all means.
Okay. Actually, it was Thursday night. I'm sorry. It was after the draw party at Pure.
Right.
After Dennis found out who he was going to play and everybody else did, a bunch of us walked out, and some of us walked next door to the Caesar's Palace poker room. And I walked in, and I recognized a couple of the guys who were sitting down at one of the tables on the rise area. Joe Hashem was there. Jason Alexander was there. Chris Moneymaker was there. Jason Mercier was there. So I went over and I sat down and said, you know, let's play. I didn't even ask him what game we were going to play or anything, which was a little silly because it could have been something way out of my league. But I figured with Jason Alexander there, I was probably going to be safe at the table. And by the way, we recorded an interview with Jason, which you'll hear probably in 2 weeks on this show. Jason Alexander and Peter Eastgate. We're going to have to get that one on in a couple of weeks as well. So the other people who were, ended up sitting down at this table, Maury Eskandani, who's the executive producer of the NBC Heads Up, and High Stakes Poker, and Poker After Dark, who will be on with us next month to talk about all of those things. Scott Lazar, who made the final table of the 05 WSOP main event and works in Hollywood on movies and TV. Donnie Peters, who is the leader of the Poker News tournament reporting team. Eric Morris, who's the publisher of Bluff Magazine. And Gary Gates, who's the media director for the North American Poker Tour. So it was essentially pros and media people, myself included. And I sat down, and it looked like they were just going to play a fun game, which is exactly what they were going to do. They're going to play 1-3 no-limit hold'em with a 500 buy-in max, which was absolutely fine because it was obvious to me everybody was just going to be sitting here drinking and playing and talking and having some fun. And that's exactly what it turned out to be. And it, right before the first hand was dealt, Chris Moneymaker says to the table, let's play the 7-deuce prop. And everybody agrees to do it, and we're going to do it for the whopping sum of $5. If you can take down a hand with 7-deuce, everybody owes you $5. So on the first hand, it comes around to Jason Alexander. He raises the $3 big blind to $10. It's folded around to me in the small blind, and I look down at 7-deuce. And I make it $70. and Moneymaker turns to me and says, that's not going to work. Like he knows what I'm doing, but he folds and everybody else folds, and it comes back around to Jason Alexander, who shoots me a look, like a death look. Like, I've got a hand here. What are you making it $70 for in a 1-3 game? And he folds, and I show the 7-2, and everybody ships me a red chip. But that was
you had to love that.
But that was not the best part of the night. I've got to tell you about this one hand that happened, I don't know, about an hour or two into the session. We only played for about 3 hours total. This was the craziest hand of the night. After a couple of players limped in, I made it $25 on the button with a pair of fours. Three people called, and the flop came out 4-deuce-deuce, giving me top full house. They all checked, and I checked as well, planning to trap somebody if they overplayed a smaller hand. When something comes out, the turn card is another four. Well, now I've upgraded from a full house to quad fours. Unfortunately, no one bets. So again, I want somebody to catch up and have something so I can make more than just a few dollars that are in the pot now. It's like a $100 pot at this point. And so I check again. And the river card is a three. So now the board is 4-2-2-4-3. Possibility of a straight. Possibility of somebody with an overpair making a move. Somebody with an ace might think that their two pair with an ace is good. Somebody's got a bet here, and Eric Morris, the guy from Bluff Magazine, makes it $70. Fold, fold, comes to me. I raise to 240. I'm hoping he has a hand. I hope he has a hand big enough to call with. Well, he does. He moves all in. I insta-call with my quads. He proudly turns over his cards, announcing, I have quads, and he turns over 2 deuces. And he thinks, obviously, that he's won the hand.
Well, yeah.
So, and I say, so do I. And I turn over my 2 fours, and the whole table explodes in laughter. Then Gary Gates asks if the hand qualifies for the bad beat. And the dealer says, yes, it does, because we're playing a 1-3 game. They've been taking a dollar out for the bad beat jackpot every time. And at Caesars, it's not like here where you can win $168K. The bad beat jackpot there is $10K. But here we are, just playing a little fun game, and we end up splitting $10,000 at the table. Eric Morris, because he lost the hand, gets $4K. I end up getting $2K. Five of the other guys end up getting $800 each. and Chris Moneymaker and Jason Mercier get nothing because they were not dealt in on the hand because they were off doing something else at the time. So just absolutely crazy. It's the first time, Dennis, I've made $2,000 in a 1-3 game.
I have to admit, that's pretty impressive to be able to do that. You know, that's almost as impressive as you say, I made $2,000 in a 1-3 game. And everybody goes, wow!
Yeah. So anyway, that was our weekend at the NBC Heads Up. We do want to get to these interviews, but first we've got to tell you a little bit about something amazing that happened on PokerStars yesterday.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if anybody else was following it. I think just a few hundred thousand people might have been. But they had the biggest Sunday Million they have ever had. It totally blew the socks off of everything. Just shy of 60,000 people that came into this thing.
Now, just to put that in perspective, listen to this. The 59,128 who were in this, that's more than all the players who have ever played in the World Series of Poker main event in 41 years combined.
In one Sunday sit-down.
Yep.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
Now, I didn't get a lot of the facts, but I do know this. It was a 9-way chop when they got to the final table.
Yep.
And each and every one of the people took down like 600 and some thousand. It was unbelievable. I think the biggest was like 800,000.
844,000. And Luke Vrabel, after the chop, they continued playing because there was a Lamborghini on the line, and you can't chop up a car 9 ways. Luke Vrabel took that down. So in addition to the 671K he won, he also got a Lamborghini out of this. 7,450 people made the money less than 5 hours into this tournament. That's how fast the 59K went down to 7,000 players. The prize pool was almost $12 million.
I played the warm-up, and I cashed in it. And I played the second chance, and I cashed in it. And I also played the Sunday Million, and never mind. When I went out, there was still like 24,000 left or something. I wasn't even in the ballpark.
Well, this is just more proof that PokerStars is the biggest online poker site that you could possibly play. If you haven't downloaded the software yet, go to PokerStars.net. You can play for free online. You can get into free rolls to end up in tournaments like this online and so much more. Download that software at PokerStars.net and find the PokerStar in you. Dennis, I'm going to let you go back to the ball game, and we're going to go to these interviews that we recorded with Joe Hashem and Phil Galfond and Vanessa Selbst, and I'll catch up with you again next week.
Sounds excellent, Paul, and thanks a bunch.
That's Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis. Back with more in a moment on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, and our podcast via iTunes and on thechipleader.com.
I don't own a suit or a tie, and collared shirts make me itch in places a collar shouldn't be able to make me itch. And I'm not a guy who can play poker on a full stomach, because like swimming after eating, I start to cramp up and give away my tells. I can't pull off a lie to myself, my friends, or my girlfriend, but I can lie to my opponents. And when I slow play a hand of poker, it's not because I don't know what I'm doing. It's so everyone else at the table thinks I have a terrible hand, when I'm actually holding an epic hand that will make grown men cry big boy tears. And that's fun to watch. I'm a chip stacking, weakness attacking, going to be wearing a World Series of Poker bracelet, World Series of Poker player. I'm a player.
Come to Harris St. Louis, March 31st through April 12th, and take your shot at a bracelet in the World Series of Poker circuit event. Meet poker stars Greg Raymer and Dennis Phillips, April 8th from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Know when to stop before you start. Gambling problem? Call 1-888-BETS-OFF or visit 888-BETS-OFF.org. Must be 21 years or older to gamble.
And we're joined now by Phil Galfond from Blue Fire Poker, who is here for the NBC National Heads Up Poker Championship and is probably one of many who wishes they would switch the format to PLO.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be fantastic.
Phil is known for playing some pretty high-stakes PLO online and multi-tabling at that. How will that be different from sitting down here and playing in a fast structure, 15-minute round Heads Up Championship?
You know, it's a lot different, to be honest. I mean, I think a lot of the skills will transfer, but deep stack PLO to short stack, fast structure, high blinds, no limits, completely different game. Luckily, I started out my career for the first year and a half playing sit and goes, so like nine-handed sit and goes, but so I do have a lot of experience in short stack play at the end of a tournament. So I, you know, as the stacks get shorter, if I can remember, like 4 or 5 years ago, I think I'll still be okay. I'm hoping to get into a lot of pots early on while the stacks are relatively deep at like 75 big blinds, because that's where I feel a lot of my edge will be.
So if you can start out and get a little advantage, then when you get deeper into it where it's going to turn into not a shove fed necessarily,
yeah.
But people are going to be much more willing to put their chips out there.
Yeah.
So if you lose a race, if you're whatever, you're still, you know.
Exactly, yeah. I'd like to build up a chip lead before we get into that time and have some room.
From the time we found out that you were going to be playing Joe Hashem to the time you're about to start your match, did you go online and see, is there video of Joe playing heads up other than in the World Series?
I didn't check, but I just doubt there is.
Probably just at the end of that, you know, main event, right?
Yeah. I have played a bit with him. I played on the PokerStars big game with Joe.
I'm going to break him in half. Why
don't you sit down right over here? There's another headset. We'll have both of you on.
Oh, good
for
grief.
For goodness sake.
I played with him a little bit, and that was a six-max game, so it was pretty aggressive. And so, you know, in that way, somewhat similar.
Yeah.
But that's our only experience playing together so far.
Yeah. You never know who's going to wander up.
Yeah.
The gentleman we've just been talking about, Joe Hashem, is now going to join us here for a couple of minutes.
If you guys are, like, talking serious, I don't want to know about it. Like. Unless Phil's going to give me, like, you know, absolute 1-2-3-pointers.
Well, you just missed it. He told us exactly how he's going to defeat
you. Yeah,
we could have been here 2 minutes ago.
We can play it back for you.
If you guys follow me on Twitter, I have a plan for Phil today.
Yeah?
If he misbehaves, I'm going to tell him to sit in the corner and think about his actions.
Now, we just asked Phil if after he found out that you were going to be his opponent, did he go online and watch a couple of the heads-up hands that you played at the end of your main event that you won?
Right.
And he said he didn't bother doing that because he thought it was probably only about a few hands anyway.
Yeah, there's only three hands were televised. And I weren't. There was nothing.
But there's plenty of evidence from a guy who runs a video poker training site, Blue Fire Poker Online, that you could be doing on him.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you say that, because I've been threatening to sign up to Blue Fire for ages.
Really?
Yeah. But, well, you know, in all seriousness, now I really respect the way Phil thinks about the game, and I wanted to see what he has to say, especially about Pot Limit Omaha. That's, you know, as that's the up-and-coming game and everyone's playing
Absolutely.
It today. So I finally did it. I clicked the button and I gave him $360 of my hard-earned money for 12 months. No discounts, too, by the way. How's that?
Wow. Yeah.
So, no.
That's a nice endorsement for your site. The site where the pros come to learn how to play.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The day that you stop learning is the day that you are no longer any good.
Oh, absolutely. If you look behind, everybody else is catching it and coming up with new items. What was the book they came out with, you know, Don't Play Like Phil Hellmuth or whatever? You know, they took 50 different previous concepts from the 90s and the 2000s and said how those don't apply anymore because the game has just moved forward so much.
The game keeps changing. And even
absolutely.
Like now, I mean, I'm 26 and they're 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds playing online and doing things that I don't understand yet. And so I'm trying to keep up as well, even.
How have you helped change the game from the time when Joe won 5-6 years ago in the main event? Because you have been part of the changing of poker.
You were the 19-year-old then.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I think I've actually done a lot for PLO. I don't think I've done much for the No Limit games. I think they've been evolving on their own and with a lot of like the high-stakes online community and... but PLO, I think that I was one of the few who was making videos that explored some new concepts. And so I do think PLO, unfortunately, in part due to me, has gotten a lot tougher in the last year. But, I mean, as far as poker as a whole, I don't think I have all that big of an impact.
Well, sorry, can I interrupt?
Go ahead.
You said something about, you know, how the game keeps changing. One of the things that I think is blatantly obvious to me today, but wasn't a few years ago, is our arrogance. Like, guys like myself, guys who had been successful before the new breed came along, and thought, you know what? Who are these young punks? Right? And it's releasing that arrogance and saying, you know what? So what? I was good in my day, but today the game is different, so I need to be to relearn or explore new concepts that are going to help me. And Phil now at 26, who he was like, he was one of the pioneers of thoughts of good thinking with, especially with PLO, is admitting to us now that he's looking at what the 19-year-olds are doing because they're coming up with different stuff, you know?
Yeah, and I think it actually went both ways. There was maybe 3 years ago or so where there was just like a mutual disrespect between the games of live players and online players. I think both communities thought the other ones just didn't know what they were doing. And I think in the last couple of years that's changed, and the live guys have realized that, you know, the online guys actually know what they're doing, and the online guys who are so fundamentally based are looking at like some small fundamental mistakes that they think live players are making, but they're realizing now that they are still extremely competent players, and like a small preflop mistake is more than made up for by good hand reading and good bluffing and things later in the hand. And I think it's the one thing that I think is really great is that I think there's a lot more respect between the communities.
One thing that I'm going to use a term that you guys coined, I think we've merged.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think our thoughts have merged.
We have a lot of listeners that fall into two different categories. Either they've been playing No Limit and are now trying to switch into the PLO because, as you mentioned, it is the growing one, the new game that everybody wants to do. And other people that are just trying to really improve their game, they're not sure how. I mean, we obviously have training sites. There are books to read. There are people to talk to. There are chat rooms. What emphasis, if they have a limited amount of time, because maybe they're working a full-time job, where should they go first? Where do they try to improve their game at? How do they try and pick this up?
BlueFirePoker.com.
Well, I'm giving you a big plug here. That's a start.
No, honestly,
that's not all.
I think training sites are great. I think the biggest thing for me throughout my career has been having friends who play poker to discuss poker with. I think that's made more of a difference than anything.
More powerful than anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can watch a video, but who do you discuss it with?
Yeah.
Right? Good point.
You know, you play a hand and then you get up and you talk to your friends about it, or at the end of a session you sit down, and this is stuff that we used to do back in the day when I was a young guy, right? We'd all just hang out and talk poker. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you get married, you have children, you got responsibilities. You just don't do that or as much of it anymore. And I think it's a very powerful tool. I agree, Phil.
Yeah, and, like, there are a lot of great players. And I have friends who are great players. And you kind of just assume that you all know the same things and play pretty much the same way. And if you ever, like, look at a hand somebody else played, sometimes, you know, like I'm looking at a hand that Tom Dwan played or some other player that I'm good friends with and respect their game a lot, and I'm like, I have no idea what they're thinking. And you ask them, and you're like, oh, that's not a bad idea. That's never occurred to me, and it's going to happen because people, you know, as much as we learn as a community, you figure things out on your own. You develop a play style on your own, and I think it's definitely important to take things from other people's styles.
You don't even necessarily have to agree with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It just discussing it opens your mind to the possibilities.
Yep, exactly.
Well, you know?
That's a beautiful point. You're absolutely right. Well, you may not play that way. You may not even agree with it. But if it helps you understand how your opponent is playing, that is valuable information.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you talked about the difference between playing online and playing cash. As a predominantly cash game player for pretty much my whole life, I enjoy it when a hot, young, online player comes to the table and sits down and within 15 minutes is completely impatient with the pace of single-table live game play.
So boring.
So do you play live and do you run into that yourself, or are you almost exclusively an online player?
I'm still like 90% online. I do play live occasionally, and like during the World Series I'll play live cash games when they have some big good ones. But it's tough, and I have to discipline myself and like consistently remind myself to stay focused and stay calm and just relax.
I think that's the biggest, one of the big things that online players find when they first come to live is they get bored easily, and two, the good online players, not all of them become good live players because they can't deal with that. They can't deal with how to control their body language, how to, you know, and you see a lot of them today. I've noticed a lot of them have got set routines of how to put their chips in the pot, because they don't trust themselves. So they've just developed a formula that I'm going to pick up one chip at a time, I'm going to place it and move it out, or I'm going to get my hand to there and just drop the chips every single time, and I'm going to do this because they're not comfortable yet. But they're the ones who will eventually become comfortable and improve. Right. You know. But yeah. I can understand how awkward it is for guys who are normally sitting there in their undies, just clicking a mouse and they can scratch whatever they like and no one sees them.
Oh, right? You'll still occasionally find a guy. You'll still occasionally find a guy in a live game with a click tell.
Another thing, adjusting from live to online, when you play so many online hands, especially if you're not a super thinking player, you can be a good player but not think things through so much. You've just developed a good system, and you're just used to playing hands in a standard way. And so, let's say I open from the cutoff, and somebody three bets from the small blind. In my online games, they're going to be three betting 15% of hands, let's say. In a live game, I might be up against a player who's three betting 3% of hands.
Yeah,
he's three betting super tight, and you have to be very focused to not just make the standard play of ace queen. I'm just going to re-raise and get it in, because you're up against a completely different range. And I think that that's one way that a lot of online guys get a lot of money in bad and just chalk it up to a cooler, when in actuality, they're playing against people with different styles and they need to adjust to it.
Yeah, and they're not paying attention to the actual game. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the guys are playing 10 tables, 12 tables. You'll never get me to agree that that's poker. You can't be playing poker doing that, right? You're playing purely the numbers, right? And then, but when you sit down and play at a live table, you have to play poker. So you have to pay attention to everybody.
I mostly agree with you. I think that there are the elements. There are a lot of the elements of poker, but it's maybe 20% as much as in a live game. There are still, you can still, especially if you're playing on a lot of tables with the same people, there's history and this happened last time, so he might be thinking this. But yeah, it's definitely much, much less than at a live game where everybody's noticed what's happened every hand. There's a lot more leveling, a lot more psychology involved.
Is one of the other big differences tells that you can spot, obviously, when you're sitting across the table from somebody as opposed to some guy who's in his basement while you're in your living room?
I mean, I'm one of those guys that Joe's talking about where I just try to do the same thing every time. So as not to give off anything, because I have played a decent amount live, but I'm not experienced enough to where I'm picking up a lot, especially from pros in terms of tells, and I have to assume that they're able to pick some things up from me. So as far as tells go, I mostly just take the approach of being pretty careful to do the same thing every time.
There aren't, today's game, there aren't that many live tells, to be honest. Everybody kind of knows. I think the biggest tell that you get today is just from bet sizing. In a live game, like you do online, but in a live game, a lot of the live players don't really understand bet sizing yet. And you get a lot of those tells of, why are they raising this much in this spot and they're not raising this much in this spot? How come he's leading into this spot for this much? I think that's today. Like the old days when you used to play against six people who were totally clueless.
Yeah.
Right? They were the...
Yeah.
looking away, scratching their ear, pretending they're not interested in the hand, or staring you down when they're bluffing. That sort of stuff, And if someone does that at the table today, I can't say, dickhead, This went out in the 70s with afros.
I'm here to tell you, it's still there. It's still there in games of 5-10.
Yeah, maybe at the lower stakes. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Thank goodness it's still there.
Well, that's good if it's still there at that level, yeah? But in the bigger games, let me tell you, there's not that stuff happening.
Well, and in the bigger games, you're probably right, but in these multiple table tournaments where you're sitting down, like in the World Series with thousands of people, they're a little harder to pick up. There are still tells there. There's the anti-gravity ones they were talking about. There's the people that clean their throats. There's the people that announce a raise where they normally don't. They don't even realize they're doing it.
Yep.
Just the small little things like that.
Yeah.
Anytime somebody does something different at a table, there's a good chance that's a tell, even a subconscious one. And I know people that are good enough right now, they can follow a person's eyes and see what card he's concentrating on the flop. That they can count the number of heartbeats on a guy by looking at his throat. So, I mean, there are people that can pick up those tails. They're a heck of a lot better than I am at it. But it's still there. It's just harder to do. It's much more skill level now.
Yeah, there are times, especially in like a World Series event, where there are some more amateur players where I think I'm picking up on some things, but I'm at the point still where I don't trust them, and I just go with the way that I want to play the hand, and then I pay attention to see if I was right or not afterwards. And,
yeah.
And eventually, maybe 5 years from now, I'll trust those things a little bit more.
Well, looking for confirmation of tells is part of picking up tells.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's a confirmed tell.
Just because you saw it once doesn't mean that that's what it meant.
Yeah. I've said for a long time that you gain much more information observing a hand than playing a hand.
100% agree. We've said that on here many, many times. The guy that starts flirting with the waitress that gets up and walks around and starts reading a book or something when he's not involved in a hand is missing a huge opportunity. And right now there are so many good players coming from online or whatever, so many good players, you've got to take advantage of any little thing you can there. And if that means that when you're out of a hand, you watch the two guys, you see their betting patterns, you see what kind of size raise they're doing or if there is some sort of a tell or something, you know, that it's so much easier to pick it up if you're not involved in the hand. It's a huge thing. You're absolutely right.
Well, guys, I think they're about to grab you and bring you in there, so I thank
cool.
you. I thank you both for coming on.
You need me? Okay, I'm coming. Just one last thing for the audience.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Go to bluefire.com, learn a few things, then come to pokerstars.net and play. Good luck.
Thanks, Joe.
Double plug. I love it.
Joe Hashem and Phil Galfond. Now, there's something you don't hear every day. Two guys who were about to be competitors in a heads-up tournament taking 15, 20 minutes to sit down with us and talk. The nice thing about it was we were right there at Caesars Palace. They were doing the NBC heads up in the Caesars Palace tournament area of their poker room, and we were set up at one of the poker tables right outside that entrance where all the players were coming in and going out. So as you heard, we sat down to talk with Phil Galfond. Joe saw us, came over, joined us, and we just love that. When we come back, you'll hear from Vanessa Selfs, who did exactly the same thing, but no one interrupted that interview. You'll hear her talk about high-stakes poker in the next segment of the Final Table Show here on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on iTunes and thechipleader.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by PokerStars.net and Harrah's St. Louis. I am Paul Harris with Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. We'll get to our interview with Vanessa Selfs in a moment. First, let me plug the big event that's coming here to St. Louis in just over 3 weeks. In fact, 3 weeks from this Thursday, the World Series of Poker Circuit event will be here for a nearly two-week run. And there will be tournaments going all day, every day. The first one is a 7 o'clock $200 buy-in. Then the next day on Friday, April Fool's Day, we start with our first ring event. And there will be one of those every day at noon, right through Monday the 11th. And there will also be events every day at 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock. A lot of them will be No Limit Hold'em, but there will also be Omaha events and horse events and six-handed events going on here. There's a seniors event and a ladies event and mega satellites and so much more. And if you want to qualify to get into many of those, come here and play at Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room during the month of March. Swipe your card in the kiosk that they have here in the poker room, and you're automatically eligible for lots of prizes, including a seat into the main event, which starts here on Sunday, April 10th. The first place winner is going to get that seat, plus seats in five other events here, plus a seat in the Greg Raymer Poker School. Greg is going to be here, the 2004 main event champion who graduated from Parkway South and became a multimillionaire playing poker. We'll be teaching you how to play tournament poker in the Harrah's Ballroom on Saturday, April 9th, the day before our main event. You can take that class, learn about that, and then go play in one of the megas later on that day. Use those skills and get yourself into the main event here. Again, for details, you go to fossilmanpokertraining.com, and if you register for that between now and the 18th of March, you can save $50 on the buy-in. So that'll be a $249 investment that could reap thousands and tens of thousands of dollars for you. Or you can win yourself a seat in the Greg Raymer Poker School and the other events here simply by coming to the St. Louis Harrah's Poker Room, swipe your card at the kiosk, and then sit down and play, because for every 2 hours that you play in the room, you get another free entry into the drawing that'll happen on March 31st. For details on all this, go to harrahs.com/STLpoker. Now, more of our coverage of the NBC National Heads Up Poker Championship from this weekend at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas.
Today, we're joined by Vanessa Selfs. I can't even call her a newcomer to it because she's been doing so well for a number of years. People don't realize that she's made, what, three different final tables, two different heads-up semifinals at the World Series. She's done an awful lot, but in the last year, she had to be about the hottest woman poker player in the world.
I'd say one of the hottest poker players, period.
Good point.
In the world.
I stand corrected. You're absolutely right. 23 different caches, over $4 million in winnings. Are you smiling?
Yeah.
You like hearing that just described, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's true. It's fun.
Yeah. Is this your first time at the NBC Heads Up?
No, I played in 2009, actually. But actually, most people don't know that because I lasted for only one round, and so I was on TV for all of, like, 10 seconds. Just, like, you know, got one glimpse at the camera, and that was it. So.
Who's your competition today?
I'm playing Ellie Lesra.
I played Ellie last year in the third round.
You got any good secrets you can tell me?
not if I want to live with Ellie. I mean, play your game. You'll do well. Believe me. I've seen you play. I have no problem. I'm just kind of glad you're in a different bracket than me.
When you come to something like this, as a person who usually plays tournaments, full ring tournaments, and you sit down in something like this, how's the strategy different from the moment you get in that chair?
Well, is Ellie here? You got to bluff every single hand. No, but seriously, like it's just a totally different game, you know. I mean, I started out playing heads up cash games was, you know, sort of my bread and butter, and I've played, you know, as you said, you know, I've made got third place in the World Series heads up event two different times. So, definitely no stranger to heads up sit and goes. I mean, it's just a completely different game, you know. There's obviously absolute hand strength, you know, goes up a lot. So if you have a pair, it's a much better hand. If you have a pair of eights, you know, and heads up, than if you're in full ring. But it's a lot more about reading your opponent and adjusting to your opponent and sort of figuring out what your opponent has, because although a pair of eights is, like, a very good hand heads up, it's sort of irrelevant if, like, seven bets go in and you're against a very tight player, then it's not going to be good no matter what. So it's much more about how your opponent plays and figuring that out quickly, because especially in a format like this, it's a very quick structure. So you really have to adjust to your opponent as soon as you can.
Many times he's come down to fourth, fifth round, fifth level, I mean, and you get it all in on a race, and that decides the whole match.
Yeah.
The whole key to this is trying to get built up a little ahead of time, doing something in the first two or three rounds, in my opinion. Levels. Sorry, I keep saying rounds. Levels. Do you have any strategy for doing that? Are you just going to be uber aggressive and go after it, or...
No, you know, I definitely think that you have to take this specific event differently than you take the, you know, other heads-up events that have maybe a slower structure. So definitely you have to be a little bit more aggressive early with your big hands. Or not with your big hands, but just in general. But I think, you know, whereas in other events you might want to be more cautious if you have, like, a second pair type hand. You might not want to value bet it because you think your opponent might have top pair or something like that. I think in this kind of structure you have to push your edges a lot more quickly in the earlier rounds. I think that's absolutely right, because once you get to the point where you only have, you know, 25 big blinds starting stack, you know, hopefully you're on the better side of that. You've got 37 blinds and they have 13, and then all of a sudden you can still lose a flip and still win the tournament. So I think putting yourself in a position where you don't have to win the first flip is really important in this event.
One thing we know from anybody's poker career has been anywhere near successful is success breeds success. You start getting on a roll, you start getting invited to more things, you start doing more things, and you just got your first shot at high-stakes poker this season. And last weekend, the first episode aired, and you told me when we met at the party yesterday that you have not watched it yet.
No, I haven't. I haven't watched the episode.
Is that because you remember what happened in some of those key hands early on?
Ouch, wow. Maybe, I mean, to some extent. I don't really love watching myself on TV anyway, but yeah, you know, like, I think it gets better after last week, obviously. Not to have any spoilers, but I had a really a hand that wasn't too pleasant. But, you know, no, I mean, I think I've just been really busy with playing tournaments and things like that, and I don't know, I already played it, so, you know, it's a lot of time. I'm in law school, I've got other things to do than.
But how was that for you to be invited to do that show? You got to sit down with your own cash. You got to bring in at least a buy-in and a half, or maybe two full buy-ins. How was your thought process before you went and did that?
Well, you know, I thought going into it that the money wasn't going to affect me, because I'm so used to, you know, with poker, you're taught that you can't view the money as actual money, and you just have to view it as numbers on the screen, and that's always been, you know, or the screen, I guess, online, but also, you know, just chips on the table in cash games live, and you know, that's always been the case for me. And so when I went in, you know, the first buy-in was like whatever. You know, I thought, you know, I had some bad information on my opponent that I'd gotten, which is unfortunate. But after that happened, you know, I only had one buy-in left. And actually, there was a hand, I guess, that's going to come up in a future episode against Antonio where my gut was telling me to stick it in and just that he didn't have a good hand. And I think the money actually did affect me. And so, you know, it's really, and I didn't stick it in. And I'm pretty sure that I had him beat. So I think it's interesting because that was sort of my first experience playing for those stakes, especially on TV and things like that. And so it did, you know, have an effect on me. But I think as As I get to more and more of these events, it's going to matter less and less. So I was on the big game, the PokerStars.net big game, and I think, for the first four episodes, I played really well. And so, making big moves that sort of didn't take the money into consideration. And so so I think as I get more experience, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Dennis, did the money affect you in that way when you got on the high-stakes poker?
The first time you're on it, I don't care who you are, it does affect. You're not used to playing at that level. You're not used to playing at that competition all at one table, or at least very rarely doing it. And, yes, it affects you to start with. It takes an hour or two to get used to it. I'm actually glad I was card dead for the first hour or two, and I got to just sit back there and watch. I think it could have been a bit of a problem if I'd had pocket tens, pocket jacks, ace jack, with a catch and a jack on the flop or something like it. You know, one of those danger hands where you're assuming you're good, but you never know.
Right, yeah.
So I didn't run into that. I got a little more comfortable. And
But you did get stuck early, like Vanessa did.
Yeah.
And did that affect how you played later on?
Yeah, I got pissed. Dang right it did. I wanted to get some of my money back, and I did.
Yeah. But that's exactly what happened to me. I think I was, too concerned with the money not affecting me with, when I had the queens and – and the guy flubs a set, and there was a bunch of live things that he did that made me think that he really wasn't that strong. But, in addition, I was sort of like, okay, well, there's 90,000 in the pot already. I really don't think he's that strong, so I have to stick it in. And I was telling myself, or in another cash game, I'd be like, okay, well, this is a really big part of my stack, not put it in. But I had to be like, I was telling myself, oh, you can't let this money affect you or something like that. And
yeah.
So sort of overcompensating for that.
Yeah. Now I'm curious, what were the things that you saw in the guy that made you think he didn't have it? Because when we saw it on TV, maybe we saw something different than you did.
Oh, just to justify this, I'm telling you, what you see on TV is so different a lot of times in my life.
That's what I'm asking.
Absolutely huge difference.
That's what I'm asking.
Right. I don't know what you saw on TV. I don't want to say exactly what it was that led me to think he's weak, because that would be
kind
of giving away a lot of information. But, he just did some things that it seemed like he was weak, and I had information in the past that, he's a crazy player and he likes to play really big pots. And with marginal hands. And so, obviously when someone calls and then you raise and then they, the internet term, click it back, I guess. Basically, minimum re-raise you out of position. It's usually a huge sign of strength. But just based on the information I had and the dead money, and maybe that information was wrong, I don't know. But people, went into it and said, he loves to, he just will spew and do stupid things in big pots, and he just loves to play big pots. And you'll see, actually, in future episodes, it makes sort of that play and that information a lot more clear, because he plays some pretty big pots with some pretty marginal holdings. So you'll see. I definitely felt a lot better about it after seeing more of the hands. But
don't you just hate it when you double the guy up and then you watch your money going a little over here and a little over there, and everybody else gets your money?
Yeah, right. Well, actually, you'll be surprised to know what end of the pots he was on, but it should be really fun to watch, I think.
Okay. Cool. Excellent.
We've never really talked about this with any of the pros we've had on the show, the notion of doing kind of reconnaissance on the people you're going to be playing. And I guess when you know ahead of time in a big cash game on TV like that, you know who they are, and you can ask around, what do you know about this person?
It's funny because I don't usually even do that. The bigger pros that have been on TV a lot, you ask around, have you played with this person, with trusted friends. But this wasn't even one of those situations. He was an amateur, and I went into it, and then someone pulls me aside before the show, and it's just like, this is what I heard about this person.
Ah.
And it's just like, I was actually talking to someone last night, sort of saying how we should just sort of ignore, I think it would be almost more prudent to just ignore that information, because so many people process information in different ways and have different ways of interpreting the same things, that if you don't know how this person thinks, that the person that's giving you information, if you don't know how they think about poker, you may not want to trust that information that you're getting.
Good point.
Very, very good point.
How much more time do you have in law school?
One more year. Well, I'm enrolled this semester, and so I'm going to be I've been going to classes a lot and doing a lot of reading and stuff. So after this semester, one more semester.
How do you juggle law school, the pressures of law school as a 2L, and the life of a touring poker pro?
Well, I'm a 3L, so that helps lot, because the first and second years were incredibly tough, and I didn't play any poker, but barely. I played three or four tournaments basically during the school year, and that was it. So it was a lot harder then. I think now, I'm just powering through. Most of my free time, if I'm on a plane somewhere, I've got all my books sort of on my iPad and just doing all the reading there, and just really making the best of my free time rather than sort of squandering it. I think a lot of poker players are, and I have been accustomed to doing.
Well, if you finish this, get your degree, I mean, are you looking at concentrating on a certain area of law? Is it going to be a back burner to the poker playing? Are you going to try and do them in unison some way or other?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be trying to do both. I mean, I'm not going to be like a lawyer, like in the very traditional sense of the word, I guess, but I'm going to be doing some sort of legal projects. And, you know, civil rights law has been my, you know, passion. So sort of like police misconduct stuff, racial justice stuff. And so I have, you know, friends that are going to get involved with good projects, and so I can work with them on those and just sort of try to make some money in poker to fund some, you know, interesting legal projects and work on those. So sort of trying to do the two in unison for a while. Yeah.
All right. Excellent.
Vanessa Selbst, JD.
scary thought.
Thank you so much for your time and good luck
thanks
here.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll have you back sometime and talk about more of the adventures maybe this summer at the series.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
It's Team Poker Stars Pro Vanessa Selbst who joins us this weekend at the NBC National Heads Up Poker Championships at Caesars Palace. And by the way, what she said about Phil Ruffin, that opponent on High Stakes Poker, was confirmed by Barry Greenstein, who we interviewed this weekend as well. That was on our special bonus edition podcast that you can get on thechipleader.com. Gus Hansen, Faraz Jaka, and Barry Greenstein. That was a great show as well. And you can get that on thechipleader.com, or if you're one of our iTunes subscribers, you'll get that downloaded automatically. All right, so Dennis is off to play in the 25K shootout at the Bike in Los Angeles, and I'm headed off to another week to prepare for another show with you. Join us next week for another edition of The Final Table from Harrah's St. Louis and brought to you in part by PokerStars.net here on 590 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com and those podcasts on iTunes and thechipleader.com.